I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe John Cantner. He's Vice President of Research at the University of North Florida, and he's past Vice President of the School for Advanced Research. Tonight, he will be at the New Mexico History Museum giving a talk called A Tale of Two Pilgrimage Centers, Chaco and Nazca. It's at 6:30 in the evening, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Great to be back.
Great to have you back. So let's talk about these two pilgrimage centers, or these two archaeological sites, Chaco, which probably a lot of people here in New Mexico know about or have visited, and Nazca, which is in Peru and which is famous for those incredibly beautiful lines that make hummingbirds and other figures and things like that. They're separated very much in both space and time. What's the connection?
Right, that's a great question. So it's interesting, when I was in graduate school, I had a fellow graduate student colleague who was working in that area, and over the years we kept on marveling at the similarities between the sequences, the archaeological sequences we were looking at.
What do you mean by sequences?
Well, so things like the way that the different civilizations developed, springing in similar kinds of environments where it's very dry, but near water, Chaco Canyon being, of course, where the Chaco washes and where there allegedly was once an ancient lake. In the case of Nazca, there's this amazing phenomenon where the Andean waters hit the coastal desert floor. They go under the desert, and then they'll spring up. And the place where Nazca is where water happened to spring up. So both Chaco and Nazca are places where water does special things. And there was other things. The geoglyphs of the Nazca lines are in many ways similar to the Chacoan road system. And both of us, my colleague Kevin Vaughn, who's at Purdue University, and I were marveling again at how similar it was that these geoglyphs and the Chaco roadways are being interpreted as routes for processionals taking place.
Now, the geoglyphs are in what way are they similar to roads?
Well, so although the most well-known geoglyphs are the ones that form the hummingbirds, the killer whales, the tarantulas, and so forth, monkeys, the vast majority of the geoglyphs are actually straight lines. So that's also true in the case of Chaco Canyon. So Chaco Canyon roadways are really straight lines that emanate out from the canyon. And, for example, in the case of the Great North Road, goes in a direct cardinal direction. In the case of the Great South Road, heads towards a prominent topographical feature to the south. And in the case of Nazca, you have the same kind of thing. You have these long causeways that shoot out towards the mountains, towards the Andes, where water is located, of course. And it's also where the various denizens of the jungle that are represented in the geoglyphs, like tarantulas and monkeys and hummingbirds, would have lived. And so there's this real sense that these geoglyphs in both Chaco and Nazca are connecting the center, the monumental center, with sources of water, with sources of ancestors, with prominent locations on the horizon. So now the current interpretations for both, this is not universally agreed to, but I think the majority of archaeologists think this, is that these were really used for processionals. That wasn't that they were used to try to transport goods or anything like that, but instead that these were ways for people to walk along the processionals, trace the routes of the hummingbird and the tarantula, and in so doing, demonstrate their faith to this particular belief system that each center would have had.
What's the difference in the way it looks and is constructed between a processional road and a road that's used to move goods and people?
Yeah, that's interesting. Some years ago, I did a computer simulation analysis using a software system called Geographic Information Systems, and I tried to simulate what the Chacoan roadways should have looked like if, in fact, they had been built in order to minimize the cost of transportation or of movement across the landscape. And, in fact, the way that people should have moved, if indeed they were trying to minimize their effort in moving across the landscape, is quite different from the way they were built. Instead, as I think many people here will know about the Chacoan road system, They go in straight linear directions. They do not diverge at all. If there is a little butte in the way, a hill in the way, a ravine, they go right over through it without making any effort at all to try to minimize the effort they would have taken in order to traverse that landscape. So it was pretty clear based on these analyses that they were definitely not being used to try to transport things. And so that then begs the question of what were they being used for? And so the next explanation, considering the monumental and ceremonially important centers that they are emanating from, is that these were used for some kind of pilgrimage or some kind of processional or some kind of effort that was related to faith, not to economy.
So that brings up kind of the interesting point that when people do things for faith or ceremonial or religious or spiritual purposes, they often make it harder for themselves than they would doing something that was for more quote-unquote practical purposes.
Right, absolutely. And anybody who's visited Chaco Canyon or has visited the area of Nazca, when the center at Nazca, the monumental center, is actually called Kawachi. The region is called Nazca and the center is called Kawachi. If you visit either of these places, you know that the level of monumentality of these architectural facilities is enormous. The amount of effort that went into building places like Pueblo Benito or Kawachi far exceeded what was necessary to actually construct these things. So the question then becomes, why are people putting so much extra effort into everything they do around Chaco and everything they do around Nazca and Kawachi? And what we're arguing is that the reasons for this is because it's a very effective way to demonstrate one's belief or faith in the system, the religious system, that is based at these respective centers.
What was the faith or religious system? I always, when I hear the word faith, I always think of kind of the monotheistic religions like Christianity and Judaism, and I wonder whether the same kind of faith is or was practiced on the American continent.
Well, that's interesting. Of course, as archaeologists, we don't have access to the kinds of information that would really allow us to reconstruct the details around a particular religious system. But we do know, for example, that for both Chaco and for Nazca or Kawachi, there's a real focus upon signs of fertility and especially signs of water, symbols that are related to that. So we already mentioned the geoglyphs, and we have, of course, all the representations of creatures that live where there's water and that don't live where Nazca is actually located. So both areas are in very dry environments. As I mentioned, it's places where water does special things. It's a religious system in which the belief, at least iconographically, is being represented by water symbols. As another example, in the case of Nazca, the Nazca made amazing polychrome pottery. And that pottery, if you've ever seen it, it's the most fanciful, heavily decorated, iconographic pottery that you might see anywhere. And it has all kinds of symbols of killer whales, of creatures from the ocean, creatures from the mountains. And again, everything is oriented around where water is. And so we can at least minimally expect that the belief system was oriented towards making sure that enough water was available for these respective civilizations to survive in their arid environments. We don't know exactly what they thought as far as specific supernatural entities or gods or any of that. In the case of Chaco, there's no representations of individual godlike entities, although we might infer from today's Puebloan people that there were some sense that there were supernatural entities that may be related to ancestors. In the case of Nazca, there is a particular figure that's often represented that you actually find in many, many different Andean societies, and it's something which is sometimes referred to as the staff god. It's an individual, sort of a short, squat individual who is either carrying serpents in his hands or staffs in his hands, and this particular image gets invoked again and again and again, civilization after civilization after civilization throughout time in the Andes. So that might give us some sense of what their belief system was oriented towards.
And who is that guy with the staff in his hands. What's it all about?
Well, we don't know, except that he does occur often with symbols of violence. So we do know that the Andean sequence, and people are probably most familiar with the Inca, but of course there's the Moche and many others who are well known for their depictions of extremely violent events, beheadings, trophy skulls, certainly lots of evidence of captors and slaves. And the staff god is both brought into those particular kinds of iconographic representations, suggesting that he has some kind of influence or some kind of control over warfare. But then again, he also is invoked in signs of fertility and the like. So that's often the case, that you see these gods having sort of dual purposes or dual existences in both extreme violence and extreme prosperity.
We're talking to archaeologist John Kantner about Chaco and Nazca. Now, your talk tonight is titled A Tale of Two Pilgrimage Centers. Talk about what you mean by pilgrimage. I mean, were there people coming from far and wide? We had recently on this program a conversation about the pilgrimage across the north of Spain, Santiago de Compostela. We have pilgrimages every year coming up pretty soon to Chimayo from all over New Mexico. What are we talking about in places like Chaco and Nazca?
Right, that's an interesting question. And it's one that's been explored for almost a century by anthropologists and sociologists. There's a number of famous scholars like Emile Durkheim, Victor Turner, who have looked at how pilgrimage is a way to, in order to bond groups together, to provide a sense of community, or what is often referred to by Victor Turner as communitas. It's a way that people sort of, they enter these liminal states by going on pilgrimages, by entering sacred places like Chaco or Kawachi, and there all of their individual differences are thrown aside in this liminal space, and they only know about their bond to one another. So that's certainly one part of an explanation, one which anybody who's experienced a pilgrimage today would know is certainly part of that. You can also take a look at, for example, Canterbury Tales and the different motivations that in Chaucer's classic, each of the individuals on the pilgrimage have their own sort of motives that they're also interested in. So there's many layers of explanation for why a pilgrimage takes place.
In a place like, let's start with Nazca, where were people coming from to Nazca? How do you know that it was a pilgrimage site? And what did they have in common, and how were they different?
Well, so in the case of Nazca, we know that people were coming to Kawachi, the center there, because they were being buried there. So if you were to go to, say,
they were walking to be buried?
Well, people were, that's a question, a good correction. So they were being transported there to be buried. So once someone died in their home village, dozens of kilometers away, then their loved ones would carry the deceased to Kawachi and inter them there.
So there's a lot of bones there?
So there are a lot of bones there, and unfortunately, because of the way that they were buried, they are prime targets for looting. And if you were to take a look at Google Earth, for example, and home in on Kawachi, you would see that it looks like the landscape has been used for bombing runs because of all the craters, and that's hundreds and hundreds of craters, probably thousands, give you some sense of the number of burials in these cemeteries that surround Kawachi.
What do people want with the bones? Or were they buried with now valuable pots? Or
right, so they're buried with valuable pots. The Nazca textiles are incredible, and of course they're preserved in the very arid environment of the coastal desert there. There's also other items like gold. So gold is certainly something which is found in some of the burials. It's not all that common, but it has been found in some of the burials. And all these items, especially the pottery, as I mentioned, that polychrome, very incredible, fanciful pottery that the Nazca people made is coveted in the illegal antiquities market. So So unfortunately, it's led to all this pond hunting. On the other hand, as archaeologists, we can see that clearly there were enormous cemeteries there, and much more than ever could have been used just for the local population of Kawachi. So the conclusion is that people were coming from long distances away to inter their loved ones.
If a person in that area at that time, what time are we talking about, by the way?
So in the case of Nazca, the height of it really is around 400 AD or so, and it starts a few centuries earlier and goes a few centuries later.
So if somebody at that time wanted to bring their loved one to be buried there, as opposed to being buried wherever they lived, which was presumably not so very close, did they have to be special, like of some class or whatever, to be buried at Nazca?
That's a good question. As far as we know, that's not necessarily the case. There isn't a lot of evidence of difference or inequity in Nazcan society. There are some burials that clearly have great wealth. One was discovered recently, which is, I think, being called the Great Priestess of Nazca. She was clearly buried with an extraordinary level of offerings, like gold, and a big gold mask, I think, was found with her. So there are some burials that show quite a lot of difference, but mostly there's a lot of equity that's being demonstrated in the material remains that are found in these burials. So we don't know for sure, but it seems like most people have access to this if they're willing to make the journey to bury their dead.
So in Nazca, from what you're saying, it sounds like the main purpose was burial as opposed to some other kind of pilgrimage. Is that correct?
So it seems like probably it's a combination of both. We don't know for sure because we can't really see pilgrimage so clearly, except when people leave things at the pilgrimage destinations. So we know they're leaving the burials, but there are other things that are coming in as well. So there's other gold items, shell, and because we see that there's quite a number of other items that are going into Kawachi, not just in the burials themselves, the inference is that people are making pilgrimages at other times of the year as well. So it's not just for burying their dead, although that seems to be one of its primary functions.
And so what were the other purposes that, as far as you can tell? I mean, this is the thing. I mean, archaeologists, you deal with bones and pots and things like that, and what we're talking about now is like ideas and feelings and devotions.
Sure. Right. It's pretty difficult to reconstruct. Again, going back to the notion that there's all the water symbolism and ideas about fertility symbolism that might exist in places like Kawachi and at Chaco Canyon, we might think that they are going there for particular ceremonies in order to try to try to engage supernatural forces to bring more rain, bring more water down in the rivers, and so forth. There's certainly big plaza areas that would have accommodated many, many people. That's always a good sign that there may have been pilgrimages taking place for large communal events beyond just using the place as a necropolis. So we think it's probably a combination of both, its use as a necropolis, but then also large ceremonial events that may have been tied to trying to engage the supernatural to bring more water.
Now, same question as relates to Chaco. What do we know about Chaco as a pilgrimage site? And also place it in time for us.
Right, so Chaco is going to be several centuries later. So the height of Chaco is in the mid-1000s. And in the case of Chaco, we know that many, many items are being brought into the canyon. It's items ranging from the cacao that has been discovered that probably was imported all the way from Mesoamerica. It's things like some of the most coveted pottery that made in the surrounding region that was brought into Chaco Canyon in huge quantities. Turquoise, of course. Chaco Canyon has the highest quantities of turquoise in one location that you'd find anywhere in the ancient Southwest. And what's interesting is that all these items that are going into the canyon, and I could go on and name many, many more, don't seem to go back out of the canyon. So someone's bringing that stuff in, and they are leaving it there, and as far as we can tell, they're not taking anything back out of Chaco Canyon. And so there's a couple of ways that could happen, but when you combine that particular pattern with the evidence of what might be called hyper-ceremonialism in Chaco Canyon. When you see that these causeways are leading people to Chaco Canyon, then you begin to think that this is probably a good case for pilgrims coming in large numbers during certain times of the year and bringing goods with them, contributing their labor to the construction of the amazing structures that you see within Chaco Canyon.
So when you've got pilgrims coming from lots of different areas and groups that are not necessarily related in the way that we might relate now because we've got such sophisticated communications, did they know each other? What did they have in common?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. One of the ideas that my colleague and I have been working with is the idea that people are engaging in these very time-consuming and costly ritual activities of pilgrimage in order to demonstrate to people that don't know them that they believe in this religious system that's based in these respective centers, that they are part of a group of adherents to the Chacon religion or to the Nazca religion, and that as they go to these centers and encounter other people who also are demonstrating their faith and their commitment to this, these belief systems, that they are able to form bonds with strangers that otherwise would take much more effort to try to establish. By going on these pilgrimages, they are demonstrating through the actual effort that they're putting into it that they are true adherents to this belief system, and that immediately connects them with others who are also engaged in these ritual pilgrimages.
And what benefit comes from that? Does it make peace? Does it make trade?
Yeah, all of the above. So it's interesting. We, at the beginning of the sequences in each of these respective areas, if you were to go back before or the very dawn of Chaco and the very dawn of Cahuachi, what you would see is a unpredictable climate. You would see growing populations because they've been relying upon agricultural produce for some time. You would see high levels of violence that are sometimes associated with these phenomena. And as these pilgrimage centers develop, those tensions begin to fade away. So tensions about the unpredictability of the environment, tensions about the growing populations and the growing number of strangers that exist, and tensions about being able to get access to sharing networks so that they can survive droughts, to get access to exchange networks so they can get coveted items like shell from the coast or items from the mountains. All that begins to fade away during the height of these pilgrimage centers. And so what we're arguing is that the development of these pilgrimage centers, and the, particularly how monumental they became, is really tied to the unpredictable and challenging environments in which people found themselves and the ability of these pilgrimage centers to provide a bonding experience that allowed them to get along better. For both Chaco and for Nazca, there's still evidence of some levels of violence, but nothing like either before or after the fluorescence of these centers.
It would be so cool to know what they actually did. I mean, what their rituals looked like.
Oh, yeah. I always dream about having a time machine to go back and just be able to take a peek and see what actually was taking place.
How does the kind of activity you are describing compare to pilgrimages, both secular and non-secular, that we might see today? I mean, as you've written about, people take pilgrimages to places like Mount Rushmore. But there's not a lot of sacrifice involved in that. You know, you save up your vacation money, get in your car, and stay at the motel.
Right, exactly. So the word pilgrimage is invoked to explain lots of phenomena where you're going, you know, to Elvis's home or something, you know,
right.
Because that's something that you know, particularly are interested in. And so so we need to make it clear that the kind of pilgrimage we're talking about is one which is really based around these monumental pilgrimage centers. They're demonstrations of faith. That's like the Hajj or Chimayo, as you mentioned before. They're really tied to going to particular locations where the symbols of faith are clearly demonstrated, where the stories of the religion are emanating, and that certainly happens today. And I think anybody, as I mentioned before, anybody who's been on one of these pilgrimages, you often do find, it's not doesn't always happen. Everybody has their own motivations, but you often find that there are bonds that are made. There is a camaraderie or a sense of communitas, which becomes part of the experience of pilgrimage. And in many cases, this does lead to the kinds of bonds that we propose happened during the Chaco and Nazca periods. And I should point out, it's not only during the act of pilgrimage itself where the value of pilgrimage is felt. People go back to their home communities. They come back often with the insignia or other symbols that they have been on this pilgrimage. And that can actually impact how those people are regarded back in their home communities. They're then seen as clearly true adherents to that belief system because they did engage in these costly activities.
And they're cool because they have a new piece of bling from that place.
They have a new piece of bling, right. So one of my challenges is looking at Chaco and trying to figure out what that new piece of bling might have been. As far as we know, nothing was being taken out of Chaco Canyon except for perhaps the stories, the knowledge, and so forth. In the case of Kawachi, the people in that region were acquiring special pieces of pottery that were being produced in that center of Kawachi, and they were taking them back to their home villages, and they would be clear symbols that they actually went on this pilgrimage. So I'm trying to investigate this in the case of Chaco. I have a couple of working hypotheses, but so far haven't been able to find exactly what they're bringing back. I should say that I was in Turkey earlier this year with a trip with the School for Advanced Research, and there in Istanbul, coming off of the plane and coming out of the baggage carousels, were enormous jugs of water. And these were pilgrims coming back from the Hajj, and they had gotten sacred water in these big jugs, which are basically like plastic jugs that you could find, you know, anywhere in the world. And it was the water itself which was the symbol of them having undergone the Hajj. And so it could be that in the case of Chaco and Kawachi, something like that is being taken back to home communities. And of course, as archaeologists, we'll never really know for sure.
John Kantner is Vice President of Research at the University of North Florida. He's past Vice President at the School for Advanced Research. And the School for Advanced Research is sponsoring his talk tonight called A Tale of Two Pilgrimage Centers, Chaco and Nazca. It's at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great.